So, how concerned are you about the economy and your personal finances? What are your questions and concerns? Financial planner Kevin McKinley has some answers and maybe some comfort. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is back with some information and advice on your money. And we welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Make that on your money at wpr.org. Kevin also has some advice on paying off student loans and creative ways to sell homes in a tough market. And also, did you know you could save some money on French fries? Stay tuned for more information on that. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Is it raining, pouring in Eau Claire right now?
Yes, it is. We had an amazing lightning storm at about 4:30 this morning here, and we're getting some rain. I can't say it's much needed, but it is nice to take some of the humidity out of the air.
Yeah, we have some downpours happening in south central Wisconsin as well, but we will weather through that, I'm sure. Speaking of weathering through things, boy, this all the economic news is pretty troubling, and all this turmoil continues to churn on a global basis. But you say the whole world is watching to see this week's comments coming from Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Yeah, it's that's where Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, is getting together with all the other governors in the Federal Reserve and other related parties. They're going to discuss the economy and what they can do to kind of help it. And hopefully, you know, make some s'mores. they're going on a mud hike on Thursday night, and there's a Girl Scout camp across the lake, and they're going to paddle over and have a tug of war and everything. But on Friday, Bernanke's going to come out and talk about what they've come up with and what the Federal Reserve is going to do, if anything, over the coming months and year. And this was a big deal because last year at this time, Bernanke came out with basically the announcement of quantitative easing 2, where they said we're going to buy about $600 billion with a B dollars worth of treasury bonds, driving interest rates down, hopefully driving stock and commodity prices up and creating more liquidity and money in the economy. And that actually worked. Everything happened just the way that he hoped and thought it would, except the economy didn't get any better. So it'll be very interesting to see what's going to happen this year.
Any indication of what Bernanke might say or do?
Probably not a lot. The interest rates are just about as low as they possibly can go. This is something that's gone on for basically 2 decades. Whenever there's been any trouble in the economy or the stock market, the Federal Reserve has come in and lowered interest rates or put together some other program to try to restore confidence and stimulate the economy. Some people are saying that the lower interest rates may have actually contributed to the problem by causing inflation, which has meant higher food prices and higher gas prices and made consumers less likely to spend money on discretionary purchases. Bernanke's already promised to keep interest rates low until 2013. He may come out with some new asset purchase program, but that might not have the effect that he wants either. And plus, the Federal Reserve does need to keep some ammo in reserve in case new crises arise.
So what else might come up at this meeting on Friday?
Well, you don't have to be too attuned to the news to see what else could go on, whether it's something that goes on here, a political crisis overseas, several large banks, the so-called too-big-to-fail banks here and in Europe, may still try to disprove that they are not too big to fail. Plus, there's global conflict going on that's affecting oil prices. If something like that, and we get a real serious problem on an urgent basis, the Fed can step in with the Treasury and hopefully do something that will get people to calm down a little bit and try to take a step back before they sell in a panic.
There really aren't any easy answers for Bernanke, or are there?
Yeah, we need a time machine. We need a time machine to either go backwards so that we can undo some of the excesses that we had 3 or 4 years ago, or we need a time machine to go forward so we can just get through this. Homes need to sell, employment has to pick up, and for all of that to happen on a really measurable note, it's going to take years, not months. So definitely expect more volatility and more uncertainty going forward.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag, and Joshua is overwhelmed by the private loans that he took out to pay for law school. And he wants to know, Kevin, if you have any suggestions as to how he can get out from under all this debt. Do you?
I have a couple, hopefully not silver bullets, but one of the things that many recent graduates of law school are learning that they did not learn in law school is the law of supply and demand. There are more lawyers going around right now than there is money to pay them. The cost of law school can reach a point of up to $150,000 or more. And based on the employment prospects and salary, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that lawyer median pay right now runs probably about $68,000 to $70,000 per year. And probably only about two-thirds of law school graduates actually are working at that type of salary right now. Now, for a lot of people, $72,000 a year, let's say, sounds like a lot of money. But after you take taxes out and take out the average debt that law students incur, it's typically about $100,000 to $150,000 once you add in their undergraduate debt. It only leaves about $2,000 after taxes and after their loan payment. And this has become such an issue that several law students are actually suing some law schools around the country, saying that the schools misled them about the placement rate and the salaries of their graduates. And so other schools are looking into some other methods, perhaps instituting some kind of a notion of almost a year of residency, where instead of paying into the system for the third year, the law student would actually earn some money practicing pro bono law or clerking for it. And so there is some possibility of help down the way, but right now it doesn't look very good for people in law school or people who have just gotten out.
I'm sorry, Kevin, I had to kind of smile when you said that these law school students are suing their law schools.
It's so appropriate. It makes me very happy. What happened is one law school Michigan called the Cooley Law School said they were concerned about some commenters online had said bad things about the program and that they were misleading people with their placement rates, and which, you know, it's almost an industry knowledge that goes on. And the school said, well, we're trying to find these people so we can sue them. Well, instead, there was a class action suit announced against the law school for the very same reasons we discussed.
That'll teach him. Well, what about Joshua, though? What can he do right now?
Actually, he should go back to his school and to the financial aid office and tell them his situation and where he's at. And there are a couple different programs that lawyers can get to help them abate their loans if they are working in public interest jobs. And they can go to finaid.com or equaljusticeworks.org to find out how they can get help if they're serving in, you know, a lower income or a public service legal professions. If for federal loans, you can also go to ibrinfo.org. That's one of the biggest requested sites that we have right now. That's an income-based repayment plan that students who have a large amount of debt, not just law students, just about any kind of student, can go to that site, get into a program, and based on their income, they may be able to lower their payments on their federal loans and then have the loans forgiven after, say, 10 years or so of regular payments. However, that is just for federal loans, not for private loans. So that program can't help him get out from under his private debt.
And if he can't get any help?
Well, he should contact the lender and explain the situation and see if there are any other programs that can allow him to put the loans together, to get a lower interest rate, to extend the payments out. Because, you know, these lenders want their money. They also don't want to have to try to go through a bankruptcy, and it's very difficult even to get these private loans and federal loans diminished in a bankruptcy plan. So if he does get a program from his lender or from another lender, definitely read the fine print before signing. But as a highly trained lawyer, he should be able to decipher the contract very easily.
What other ways might provide some relief?
He might approach a relative and say, you know, a grandparent, let's say, and say, you know, I've got these loans. I'm trying to pay them off, but the interest rate is really high. If we could set up some kind of contract where you could pay the loans off and then I would repay you at a lower interest rate or a longer payment plan. He also might go to a peer-to-peer lending site like Prosper.com and explain his situation and see if there's someone willing to lend him money at a lower interest rate. He could also go to a bank or credit union and see if, based on his credit rating and hopefully his earnings, he might be able to get some money to offset the loans. But when it comes down to it, he could work nights, get a second job, try to live as cheaply as possible. And one of the reasons I'm glad he wrote in is I hope we can get him some help, but I'm also want this to serve as a lesson to people. If you're going to go to law school, if you're going to go to graduate school, even if you're going to go to college to get some kind of a job, don't think that the degree is some kind of magic wand that's automatically going to not only get you a job, but get you a job at a high salary. If you borrow a lot of money to go to school, it's one of the best reasons to borrow money. However, you have to expect that even when you get out of school that you are going to be broke for several years while you try to not only get a job and earn money, but also pay off your loans.
Talking with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, about your money. And if you have a question about your personal finances, our number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money.
You are listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin is with us just about every Tuesday at this time to answer your personal finance questions and to provide you with some information and advice on your money. Our first caller today is Dan in Three Lakes. Hello, Dan.
Good morning. I would like to know more about long-term federal treasury bonds, like the 30-year bond. How do you acquire them? Where do you get them? What do they pay? Are there commissions involved? Are they sold at a discount? And how do you bail out early if you have to? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Everything Dan wants to know about long-term treasury bonds, Kevin.
In 30 seconds.
Yes.
Go. Yeah, well, treasury bonds are interesting because they pay interest, and they're fairly safe, even with the recent struggles that the United States has had with the ratings agencies and the concerns about a long-term fiscal health. They're still in very high demand. They pay about 4% once you get out to that 30-year range. The interest is usually exempt from state taxes but not federal taxes. There are several ways you can buy them. You can buy them from the Treasury Direct at treasurydirect.gov. You have to create an account there, but there's usually just a small fee to do that. You can also buy them in the open market through a brokerage firm, a regular one or a discount one like Charles Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard accounts. You should also look at buying them through mutual funds, which just aggregate a bunch of treasuries and then have a bunch of buyers like Dan and other investors in the fund for it. Here's the problem with it. Treasuries are very safe in the sense that if you hold a treasury until its maturity, you're very likely to not only get your interest, but get your principal back. But if you need to get the money before the bond matures, you will be subject to fluctuations in the market. And fluctuations might be if interest rates rise or people become even more concerned about the United States' ability to pay off its debt, you will probably lose value on that bond if you go to sell it. So if you're comfortable with that risk, I'd go ahead and still continue looking at treasuries. However, I'd much rather have people who are looking for a safe form of fixed income to go out and buy a certificate of deposit, which is FDIC insured and has much less a fluctuation in the value of it between when you buy it and when it matures, meaning you typically only have a small penalty for early withdrawal if you pull it out before it matures.
Kevin, someone I know who I won't name in case you ridicule them right now is recommending or having good luck with municipal bonds. and said, hey, you should look into municipal bonds. Should I look into municipal bonds?
Municipal bonds offer a pretty good proposition on a risk-reward basis, meaning they generally pay a fairly high rate of interest. In some cases, they pay a higher rate of interest than CDs and treasuries pay for a similar maturity. The reason is because they're not as safe as CDs and treasuries of a similar maturity. Even if they're insured or they have a AA backing for it, the nice thing about it, of course, is you get interest that is ostensibly free from federal and maybe even state income taxes. So you get to keep more of what you earn. The problem is that municipalities can't just print money. And if they go through a revenue slowdown because of a downturn in the economy on a regional basis or their project isn't working out, they might not be able to pay the bond off. Also, municipal bonds are highly illiquid in most cases, meaning if you buy it and then you sell it, it's like trying to buy and then sell a car very quickly. You lose a lot to the overhead. So if you are going to buy it, it should be a bond that you buy for the long term and to hold on to rather than something that you're going to trade back and forth.
Our next caller is John in Schofield. Hello, John.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to run a scenario by Kevin. I have our daughter bought a house 11 years ago in a good location. The house is paid for. She did a lot of work on it. I helped her doing some things. The floors are much nicer. The kitchen was upgraded. The woodwork was cleaned up and stuff. We put a rec room in the basement, also a shower and a toilet and a sink. She did have a new roof put on it. She has a good job. She's a chemist. She has a pretty solid job. And she has a 14-year-old son that she's invested money in 529s, and she'd like to do the same thing with another house now, looking at selling it maybe down the road a year or two when the market comes back. She has the money for a 20% down payment. In fact, I think it's 25% for a better interest rate. She's gotten a pre-approval letter from a bank, and I'm confident on her ambition to go through all this, and I'm just enough of a wood butcher to help her do some things. And I just wonder what Kevin thinks about the whole scenario. And if worse come to worse, she might want to have to rent it for a year. I think she's going to take 6 months to a year working on it. But what does Kevin think about the scenario? And what are any maybe pitfalls on renting it in the end? That's a long way of asking a question, but see what he says.
No, I just the fact that we got to get the word wood butcher on the show here, it's a first. I've done this show since 2003 or something. And
there's a lot of sawdust flying.
I'm going to start using that word wood butcher a lot more. I don't think it's a denigrating comment, but well, I would say this. If she's doing it because the house, a new prospective house, is right for her, I think it's a good idea. So it might be in a nicer neighborhood, it might have more amenities, or it might be closer to work. But if she's doing it to make money and she thinks that she's going to sell this current house at a higher price somewhere down the road, we are going to talk about this later on in the show, John. But I just don't see how housing prices are going to jump up a lot. I just don't think interest rates are going to go a whole lot lower. And even when they have gone lower, there hasn't been a huge demand for prices for houses at the current prices. So I would do it, but in a strange sense, I wouldn't do it for the money. I'd do it because it's the right time to do it. Now, if she does do that, she should sell the house as soon as she can. I wouldn't advise that she rent it out because there's a lot of headaches to that. Only if she can't sell it, then that's one option. But when she buys the new house, she should put as little down as the lender will allow, and she should get a new 30-year fixed-rate mortgage to pay for it.
She's looking at the 30-year mortgage. So thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much, John, and good luck with that wood butchering. Kevin, why don't we move right into our smart assets segment of the program? We were going to talk about home buying and home selling. This is sort of the end of that season. You have some advice on unconventional methods of dealing with an unsold home?
Yeah, a lot of these people who have listed their homes for the past few months or even the past few years, this is a time which really brings a lot of anxiety because, it's the beginning of the school year, winter's coming on, and typically that means that the home buying and selling season is coming to an end. And now, July was a pretty good month in Wisconsin for home sales. The actual volume, the number of units sold, was up about 34%. Mm. Over the previous year, but the median price was down almost 6%. So people people are either buying less expensive homes or the prices are falling as well. As I mentioned with John, we're unlikely to see lower interest rates down the road and very unlikely to see higher demand for it. And many people who are trying to sell their current home, if they can't do it, it's holding up a purchase of another residence. You can just cut the price down, but that may still not attract buyers. So for people who are kind of stuck between trying to get rid of their old home and get a new one, we have five ways to make the best of the situation.
All right, what's way number one?
Well, and this seems shocking to people who are trying to sell their home, but not shocking to both the people who listen to this show on a regular basis. It's to get a new mortgage on the old house. And again, as I mentioned to John, get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage for as much as possible. That will provide some cash from the home so that people can buy the new place with it, or they can rent a new place with that cash. It gets them some equity out of the house. And this is one that can be very valuable. They can't get the new mortgage without getting an appraisal of the home. And that is a true sense of what the home is really worth. That's what any prospective buyer is going to run up against when they try to buy the home and get a mortgage to do it. And so it also, the money from the mortgage gives people some help with the next step.
Which is?
To rent it out. There's actually a very high demand right now for people, for homes that are nice homes, not just, you know, smaller apartments. These have a very good demand right now as well. But for people who want to buy in single unit residential homes, they have the income, but maybe they have some uncertainty on in their lives, or they've had a recent ding to their credit rating, or they don't have money for the down payment. And typically you could rent out a home for about 0.75% of the value per month. So if you have a $200,000 home, you could probably get anywhere from maybe $1,200 to $1,500 per month. That income can be used to cover the payment on the mortgage you might have taken out, or the new mortgage you have to take out to buy your next place. And you might get some tax benefits. But as I mentioned to John, there are a lot of headaches into being a landlord, and there might be some zoning issues as to whether or not you can actually rent your home out to someone else. But if you can get this type of arrangement set up and the people really like living there and they improve their situation, you may be able to eventually sell your home to those people and to do it on a land contract.
How do land contracts work?
Well, basically, you become the banker. The buyer gives you a down payment for the home and then makes payments to you. If they can't pay, you generally get the house back, and you get to keep all the money that they have sent to you, and you get, you know, to collect some interest on it as well. Now, if you do this, of course, you need to get it in writing. You need a very firm document that spells it all out, including what the people buying the home have to do to keep the home in good shape, because you might end up getting this back. So if you're doing this, you definitely want to see a lawyer who's experienced in land contracts and a CPA to discuss the tax implications.
Can we put them in touch with Joshua?
You can use the word.
That would help. So you had mentioned lowering the price. Why can't the seller just keep on dropping the price until someone snaps up the house?
That probably would work eventually, but the way this is such an emotional decision, if you put your house on the market for, say, $250,000 and you knock it down, say, $10,000 a week every week until it sells, some people might say, hey, this is a really good bargain. Other people might look at it and say, whoa, what's wrong with this? Why have other people not jumped on this thing as the price has gone down? Instead, there are a couple different methods that you can use that you might be able to sell your house and for a relatively fair price of what the market will bear. The first one is you lowball the buyer. Say you have you've listed your home and couple tours it, and they really like it, and they just, you know, taking pictures, and they come back again, the inspector's with them, but you just don't get an offer for them. Contact the buyer and give them a price that's substantially lower than what your asking price is, maybe 80 to 90% even of what you're asking for, but tell them that they have 48 hours to say yes or no. It helps you find what the real price of the home is worth, and it creates a little pressure on them so that they feel like they're going to lose out an opportunity for a home they really like. And I think a lot of what happens here is that many sellers actually would take a much lower price, but the problem is that most buyers in Wisconsin are just too nice, and they don't want to insult the sellers by feeling like they're lowballing them, and so they just walk away and nobody's happy.
So any other ways or another way to cut the price and sell the home?
Well, this is a last resort, but it's a very effective one, and that's to have an auction. You can do one online. You can do one, a local one at place with sealed bids, you know, with open bids, whatever. You can set a reserve But that's going to scare away some buyers because they say, well, you're just, you know, putting the price in where you want to get for it. Or you can set no reserve, which is probably going to attract more buyers and more bidding, but it also means you might get substantially less than what you're planning on from the home. If you do this, find an auctioneer and a service that has experience in putting on these kind of auctions and definitely get the word out about it through plenty of advertising.
Yeah. And Kevin, do you have general advice on if your home hasn't sold at the end of, you know, the traditional season, do you take it off the market for winter, or do you just keep that sign out there?
I think you take it off the market, and especially after, you know, Halloween. If it hasn't sold by then, it's probably not going to sell, so it's better off to take it off the market and relist it back in March. One thing I would definitely tell, I'm still surprised that realtors don't do this, make sure the pictures of the home that you're listing are concurrent with the season.
Mm-hmm.
If I see a home picture right now and there's 3 feet of snow in front of the front yard, I know that this thing's been on the market for a long time. It's not very attractive. And so get the picture out with a nice green grass and sunshine to reflect the current environment.
Good advice. You know, Kevin, we had one of our former now co-workers at Wisconsin Public Radio recently moved to another state, and he had to sell his home in Wanakee, Wisconsin, beautiful Wanakee, Wisconsin. He put it on the market for 1 hour, and last week it was sold. How did that happen?
It was probably fairly priced in a great community, and it just hit right for the people looking to do it. And there are, don't get me wrong, with interest rates at, you know, 4.25% on 30-year mortgages right now, people are definitely ready to buy, but they just, the prices that they're willing to pay or even can pay are not going to be what they were, say, in 2006 or 2007.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire, and he is here to answer your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question you'd like to run by Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Back to the phones, and Jason in Chippewa Falls is with us now. Hello, Jason.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Joy.
Morning.
Hi, Jason. I have a couple of questions. When I bought a home with that first time home buyer credit, the $8,000, and I got lucky enough to get it where I did not have to pay it back. Now, we have since moved in my father-in-law who had a stroke. We are running out of room at our current home. Wondering what the rules are as far as selling that home, because we're also getting married here in less than a month.
Ooh, lots going on, Jason.
Yeah.
So,
and then I'll go ahead.
I'm sorry, Kevin, do you have questions for Jason?
No, I'm just enjoying the conversation with Jason we're having right now. Don't mind me. Carry on.
Yeah, so what are the rules?
Well, so you're going to sell the home, and what you're concerned about is that you may have to repay the credit, right?
Correct.
Yep. For homes, when did you purchase it? In 2009?
It was February, will have been 3 years. I know there is a 3-year rule on that.
Yep.
Yeah, almost seeming too far away.
Yeah, well, here's what I would do, actually, if I were you. If you really say, look, we really need to sell this and we need to get out of it right now, I'd put the price in a little higher to account for the fact that you're probably going to have to repay the credit for it. And you only have to repay it as once it ceases to be your main residence. So that might be an issue for you already, but, you know, only if you're audited and it's found out. I would put it up for sale if you're going to sell it and just not have the tax credit be the tail that wags the dog in the rest of your life, which it sounds like you have a lot going on for, as Joy mentioned. So put it up for sale, but then also raise the price a little bit to reflect the fact that you might have to sell it and give back some of the money eventually. And then after the window has expired, and if it's not your main residence anymore, then you can lower the price accordingly because you know you're going to pocket some extra money without having to pay that back. But, I'd like to see it put up to see what you can get for it now, and then if you can't get for it, wait till after. You said February is when the 3-year limit expires?
Yeah.
February 2012?
Okay. Correct.
Yeah, if that works for you, we'll put a link up to the website on it's form 5405 that has the information for claiming the credit, I think, and then there's another form on it that gives you the information about what you would have to do to repay it and what the parameters of that are. So we'll put that up at our website onyourmoney.com later on today.
Very good. And then one more quick question. I also have some student loans that impacted my credit since I bought the house. I'm just wondering if it's better off for me to pay those student loans off, or is it better for me to keep that money in the bank as a down payment on the home?
Yeah, keep as much money in the bank as you possibly can. The advantage to your credit to having no debt out is not nearly as strong as having the cash flow to make the payments and live off of. I mean, if you had, let's say, $20,000 of loans and $20,000 in the bank, and you used all the cash to pay the loans off, all of a sudden you've got no cash. So if something else comes up, not only can you not make the down payment on the new place, but you can't pay for your other living expenses. So no, definitely just keep making the slow payments. And don't worry, slow payments, but payments on time really do eventually help your credit report. So it's not the worst thing in the world to have those outstanding and still have the cash.
Jason, thank you very much for the call, and good luck with all that going on in your life. Craig in Onalaska is with us now. Hello, Craig.
Good morning. My question is, what are the legal requirements for a homeowner to hire a neighborhood kid to do chores? The kid would like to put money into an IRA, and I'm wondering from a Social Security and state and federal income tax and whatever else there is, what do I have to do?
Is it informal in the sense where it's, you know, it's going to be mowing lawn and yard work, or?
Yeah, kind of mowing grass, you know, raking leaves in the fall, snow in the winter, that type of thing. Nothing on a day-to-day basis, just kind of a hit-and-miss thing.
Sure. How old is the kid in question?
17.
Okay. Most of the burden actually falls on the worker to not only pay in and report that income as self-employment income. It's not so much on you. And we're going to talk a little bit in a few weeks about hiring what they call domestic workers for work around the house or nanny or cleaning or what have you. But it's actually the kid can use that income, any income, for the contribution to an IRA or a Roth IRA. And I'd actually recommend the Roth IRA because the kid's probably going to be in a very low tax bracket, so it doesn't provide a whole lot of benefit for him to get a tax break on an IRA contribution. Instead, the Roth IRA gives no tax break on the deposit, but he can pull the money out tax-free in retirement, and he can pull the contributions back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And his folks can actually, if they want to, they can let him spend the money that you pay him, and they can put their money into a Roth IRA for him. Now, it is a gift to him. It's his money. But that's a really neat way to take advantage of some extra income if he's willing to earn it.
Okay, so I don't have to pay Social Security. How about, does he have to pay Social Security on it?
Yeah, it's up at a certain limit. It's after, I can't remember the number, but it's something like $400 or something like that. He won't owe any income taxes on it because it probably earned less than the minimum amount for it. But it depends on if he goes as a self-employment or as a an employee or whatever. But no, usually in this situation, there's actually no problems whatsoever on your side for it. It's actually the kid has to do some more reporting, but if they have their taxes done by a qualified person, that person will ask the question if he had any earned income during the year.
Okay, I got you. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Craig. If you have a question for Kevin, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
Give me back my French fries, 'cause you know they taste so good. Give me back my French fries, 'cause you know they taste so good.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And Kevin, we have talked about saving money on groceries and restaurants before, but this week you're going to tell us how we can save money on French fries?
Yes. Not only can you save money, but you should save money on it by hopefully purchasing less, which a lot of people are doing. America has had a centuries-old love affair with the French fries. Matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson was in the White House as the president in 1802, and for a dinner requested potatoes served in the French manner, Which is how I order them when I go through the drive-through. And they have a hard enough time understanding me as it is, but when I do that, I get all kinds of strange responses for it, too. July, I think 19th was National French Fry Day. Last week was National Potato Day, so it's overdue that we cover this. Americans eat about 29 pounds of French fries per person per year. That generally works out to about one supersized fries at a fast food place per week. But there are many health concerns, obviously, about French fries, and new ones are coming to light. And plus, costs. Potatoes are one of the commodities that are rising in price and making it more difficult for processors to sell at the old price and for restaurants to give away. So we're going to talk to you about how to get the best fry for the least amount of money.
And what about those health concerns? They have they've been around for a long time, haven't they?
Yep, the big fryer is taking them seriously, though, and McDonald's. The Harvard School of Public Health said that they studied thousands of people over a long period of time, and they said that potato chips and French fries were the primary source of weight gain for a lot of the people who did gain weight. McDonald's is the largest buyer of French fries. They buy about 1/12 of the potatoes in America every single year. And this is a big deal because they are changing their Happy Meals so that they're adding fruit. You know, I have kids, and the Happy Meal is like, I mean, it's like a drug for them. For some reason, it's, you know, when my daughter, one of the first things she could visualize and identify on site was the golden arches. So McDonald's really knows what they're doing and trying to draw kids in with these things. And when you got a Happy Meal, you could only choose either fruit or fries. Well, McDonald's is bending to public pressure, and they're adding fruit to the Happy Meal, so you get fruit and fries and reducing the amount of fries in there. The reaction to this, of course, has been, you know, it's not enough, they should be doing more, or this is the beginning of the nanny state and kids should be able to eat as many fries they want. And other people are saying it's just a cynical move because the cost of potatoes cost more than the little bits of fruit, so McDonald's is actually going to be saving money by making this move. I'm not sure any of that is true, but it's probably somewhere in between.
Yeah, I was going to say all of the above, maybe. So, well, you know, it's been a while. I'm trying to avoid French fries to keep my girlish figure. But McDonald's, I remember having good fries, and they get high marks for their fries. I'm not sure if it's the grease or the salt or what it is.
Well, it's the grease, it's the salt, and mm-hmm. I think more work it goes into the technology behind perfecting their French fries then went into, you know, creating the nuclear bomb. It's just an ongoing process where the grades of potatoes and the strain of it and the temperature of the oil, they're always trying to get it just right. And more importantly, for McDonald's anyway, is to keep it consistent. Other fast food chains are reacting to this. And just recently, Wendy's added some skin-on fries that have gotten some high marks. Arby's is coming out with a sweet potato fry that's done well. And Consumer Reports said that McDonald's, the fries were very good with their testers, but Wendy's were just a little bit better.
So with all food prices rising, it really isn't a big surprise that fries are more expensive, too. What is the best way to save money on French fries, Kevin?
Well, Americans have a propensity to always go with the extra value meal because we like extra value. Extra sounds good and value sounds good. So if you can get that with meal, that sounds good. The problem is, of course, that this is the caloric increase. So the thing to do is to get the largest fry you can possibly order and then split it with the members of your party. And if you can't, take it home and throw them in the freezer. They cook up really nicely in the oven or the microwave for it. We here at the On Your Money iTeam investigation went through, and my kids and I were on vacation with my wife, and we sat down and got the pencil out and figured out which was the best deal for McDonald's. And what we found is you generally, when you bump up from one size to another, to small, to medium, to large, the price does go up, but you get more fries than the price rises. Generally, it's about an 8% benefit for it. Now, that said, and again, my kids said to me, I talked to them about why, you know, they should be eating more vegetables and everything. They said, we do like vegetables. We really like French fries.
said, yes.
It's not the point. The best way to make fries inexpensively and have them very healthy is one of our favorite recipes on Your Money is get some Yukon Gold potatoes, leave the skins on, and cut them into 1-inch cubes. Toss them with some oil. Generally, peanut oil works the best, just to get a very light coating on them, and then dump them in a roasting pan, put them on for about 25 minutes at 500 degrees, and then flip them around about halfway through so they don't burn on one side. Kids will love these. They're much better for them than store-bought French fries or ones you get at the restaurant, and they cost about 10% to make versus buying the French fries at the restaurant.
Ooh, yum. That sounds good. What about, and you could use sweet potatoes, too. What about that?
Sweet potatoes, even better. The kids, you know, we fooled them. We said sweet potato, and they said, oh, that sounds good, and then they tasted them. They realized there was nothing sweet about it, so they're actually smarter than we give them credit for.
Yeah, how do your kids appreciate your vacation experiments like this, Kevin?
As long as it keeps the vacation tax deductible, they enjoy it, so very happy with it.
Very good, very good. Well, time for a few more questions for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our next caller is Vicki in Eau Claire. Hello, Vicki.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question for Kevin. I want to give my house to my son.
Not sell, give.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
How do I do that?
Oh, wait till the holidays. Yes, this is yours.
Yes, it is.
you can actually do that, and that's not an uncommon sentiment with families who are in a position of both resources and need. The house is probably worth more than $13,000, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay, then you can do this without incurring a gift tax, but you have to file a gift tax return and use some of your exemption, which I think is up to $5 million. You have a lifetime exemption. You can give $13,000 per year to anybody you want, as many times as you want. And then you also have a lifetime gift that's up at $5 million right now. So I would definitely get a CPA to do this. You also want to get a lawyer so that you can handle the paperwork appropriately and make sure that it really goes into your son's name. Now, you're just going to give it to him. It's all of a sudden, it's his responsibility, right?
Yes.
Ooh, okay. There's a hesitation there.
Well, I plan to pay the taxes and whatnot. I'm still living in it, so.
Okay. Are you going to remain in it after you give it to him?
Yes.
Okay. He's not like 3 years old or anything, is he?
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. How old is he?
32.
Perfect. Yeah. I would do something that says, gives you the right to remain there. I would have that written into it.
Okay.
And you may also want to just be cautious that once you give it to him, it's his home. If he pledges it as a lien and can't pledges it for a loan and he can't repay the loan, he could lose the house.
But then I would move in with him.
This is sounding like much in the way that John from Schofield, our caller from a while back, had done a lot of work for his daughter's home. I was going to ask him if he'd actually built a little spare room just for himself with an entrance in and out. But no, Vicki, it's actually not a bad idea because you never know what's going to happen in your son's life. And so I would write something that says you get the right to live in this house and in return he gets a great house for free and you continue to pay the taxes for it. So there's nothing wrong with that. I would also check with the lawyer to say what happens if he gets married and then gets divorced. Do we have to sell the house? What happens if he gets in a car accident, doesn't have insurance, and he gets sued? Do we lose the house? All those different issues that lawyers like Joshua are trained to ferret out can be put into the paper to protect you from that instance. So, no, otherwise, I would definitely go ahead. I think it's a great deal for both of you, hopefully.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right, Vicki, thank you very much for the call. What a nice mom. Andrew in Sun Prairie is with us. Hello, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I live in Sun Prairie. I own a duplex, and currently we're in a land contract that we're 6 years into at 5.75%. And I'd like to take advantage of some of the low interest rates. But the house doesn't qualify for a conventional Fannie or Freddie loan because when we got the appraisal done, there weren't enough comparables to make it a saleable loan. So I'm considering a 7-year fixed with or a portfolio loan that would be variable after 7 years. And the rate on that is like 3.38%. What do you think of that?
I think it's actually a pretty good deal. And this would be a new loan, so the clock would start ticking on the 7 years from 2011, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, do you plan on living in the place for 7 years?
We plan on owning it for indefinitely.
Okay. But you may not live there, right?
Correct.
Okay. No, I think it's a great deal. One thing I would check is, I think the 7-year, it's basically an ARM. It's an adjustable rate mortgage, but the current rate is fixed for 7 years. And then there's after that, it can start to float. It's tied to an index. And the interest rate probably can only go up a certain percentage every single year, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, check into that just to make sure. But no, otherwise, I think that's a really good deal. And chances are, especially if you have a renter paying in to help you off, you might be able to get it paid off in that time as well. So that's a good way to build up some equity really quickly. So no, Andrew, it sounds like a nice deal for everybody.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm getting a lot of home and mortgage-related questions. Next is Mark in Green Bay. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi, Mark.
Last week or the week before, I heard part of the program, and you were advising a person to refinance to the lowest possible rate on their home and then pay the lowest possible payment each month.
Yep.
I recently refinanced. I thought to continue to pay at my previous rate so I would pay less interest. But after listening to you and thinking about how I'd like that extra cash each month, I thought I'd call and see if I could get the whole context of that advice and what you recommend.
Sure. A couple things about your question. First of all, part of the show is all that most listeners can stand, so I don't blame you for only getting part of it. Second of all, every show we say to get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and pay it off as slowly as possible, so it could have been a couple weeks ago, it could have been a couple years ago. Yes, I would definitely agree to do that. And most people I run into, they have a situation where they have other money that could be going into retirement plans or other paying off other debt or whatever. And 30 years to pay off a 4% interest loan that can be tax deductible is probably the cheapest money they're ever going to borrow going forward. So, yes, I would definitely pay it off as slowly as possible and just build up cash and liquidity. And if you're just, you get several hundred thousand dollars and you say, I can't do anything else with this money, slide some over and pay it off.
I have a 15-year loan. I refinanced to 15 years. Would the advice still be the same? Pay it off at the lowest possible rate?
Even more so, because your payment is higher on the 15-year than it would be on the 30-year. So, yes, do it as slowly as possible.
And so that extra interest, I'm better off using that money now for something else?
Yes. The liquidity is more valuable than the interest is costing you.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, Mark. Thanks very much. Just a brief answer to a last caller's question, who currently has a 15-year mortgage and wants to know if she should refinance to a 30-year. The answer is yes, Kevin?
Yes, it is. And even if she does that, and she, a lot of people like 15-year mortgages, you can take out a 30-year and make the same payment that the 15-year would have required, and you'll probably still be able to pay it off in about 15 and a half years. But you generally don't want to do that, so you can keep the money set aside and save for retirement, et cetera.
So we have time now for the website of the week.
Well, it is the back-to-school season, as anyone with children is aware, and there's always a question of you like the convenience of shopping online. It's quick, it's easy, but you also want to shop local. Well, Wisconsin residents can do that by going to discountofficeitems.com, which is based in Columbus, Wisconsin, has a really nice website, and they were just named to Inc. Magazine's list of fastest-growing companies, discountofficeitems.com, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com later on today.
Oh, good. I hadn't heard of that. I'll have to check it out. So, four more words before we go, Kevin.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He's managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And he will be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you are with us tomorrow. We'll talk about back to school time and what parents can do to make sure kids get the most out of their education. I'll talk to the author of The Good School tomorrow morning after 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.